This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Hey everyone, it's Estet Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
While I may not be as emotive sometimes about my sense of anger or frustration or injustice, and I would argue that some people are given more room to be emotive than others. I would not be doing any of this if I were not propelled by a level of passion.
I'm Katie Kingsbury from the New York Times editorial board, and welcome to The Choice, a new podcast that brings you behind closed doors and into the exclusive deliberations process around the New York Times pick for the 2020 presidential candidate. In each episode, you'll hear Democratic presidential candidates make their pitch as they interview for the biggest job of their career. Every election year, the board chooses a candidate after closed-door, off-the-record interviews and a lot of internal debate. But the stakes are so high in 2020, and we think voters deserve to hear how we decided on our pick as the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. So we're giving you access to these conversations and the debates that followed so you can make the choice for yourself. To learn more about how the board works and who's on it, go back and listen to episode 1 of this series. We've trimmed each of these interviews down, but if you'd like to read the full transcript, you can find them on nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. From the Minnesota senator to the mayor from Indiana, Pete Buttigieg was the next candidate to sit down with us.
I'm a proud son of South Bend, Indiana, and I am running for president of the United States.
He's the 18th Democrat to join an already crowded field. For some, he's already the party's new hope to win back the heartland.
At 37 years old, Mayor Pete may be the youngest candidate in the field. But after two terms as mayor of the college town, South Bend, Indiana, he actually has more governing experience than some of his opponents. Mr. Buttigieg took a leave of absence from his post as mayor to serve in Afghanistan as an intelligence officer in the Naval Reserves, making him one of two veterans running. Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard is the other. But before becoming a public servant, Mr. Buttigieg worked for the management consulting firm McKinsey, which is known for some questionable clients and practices. He presented his time there as a kind of capitalist credential that gave him, quote, real-world experience and distinguishes him from his more democratic socialist rivals. But McKinsey consulted for the federal agency ICE on the logistics of its cruel crackdown on immigrants and worked with other brutal and corrupt governments like China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia. They reportedly advised Purdue Pharma on how to, quote, turbocharge opioid sales and were involved in advising a Canadian grocery store chain to inflate the price of bread. Until December, the mayor had not been forthcoming about his experience at McKinsey, so that's where we knew we had to start. We apologize for the audio being rough at times. We recorded in a glass room overlooking the beautiful Port Authority bus terminal using wireless mics that are great for television, but not ideal for podcasting.
Thank you for coming. So We have heard you obviously talk about healthcare and climate and the Middle East a lot in the debates, so we're going to try to ask you some questions we haven't heard you answer in the past. And you will be shocked to hear that we'd like to start with your time at McKinsey. You graduated from Oxford with sterling credentials. You could have pursued any number of career paths from there, including the choice you ultimately made to join the military. Can you walk us through why you decided to go to McKinsey from there?
Yeah. So the biggest thing was that I had a great academic education, but was beginning to feel that there wasn't as much real world experience mixed in with it. And that in particular, I was eager to do as many things as I could, touching as many fields as I could, and to understand business in particular, but how people and money and goods move around the world and how that works.
So you just didn't want to make a lot of money?
I definitely noticed the paycheck, and that was important too. I needed to make a living. I'm not going to pretend that that wasn't on my mind too.
We'd like to talk about some of those real world experiences. So one of the companies you worked for, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, you said that you were analyzing costs there. And after you completed that project, the company moved ahead with hundreds of layoffs and rate increases. Did you understand that what you were doing as a McKinsey consultant at that company, that you were working to prepare for layoffs and price increases?
I had nothing to do with premiums, prices, fees, or anything like that. Mostly what my team was looking at was overhead. There's no way to know the relationship between analysis I did in 2007 and decisions they made in 2009. But certainly our focus was making sure that cost was under control there.
But you surely understood why a company like that would hire McKinsey to come in.
How do you mean?
When companies hire consultants, they're usually trying to reduce their costs, right?
I think that's the only cost-cutting study I did out of all my time at McKinsey, so I'm not sure it's accurate to say that that's what most consulting work is.
So it surprised you when that resulted in layoffs and price increases? That didn't seem like what you would have done if you had had that information?
I wasn't following news out of Michigan in 2009, so I found that out since. But yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, if an organization needs to cut costs, then that can involve layoffs.
Another of your clients, Loblaws, the grocery chain, has since said that it was involved in the price fixing of bread during the time that you were analyzing grocery prices for them. I'm curious first, just did you analyze the price of bread for them? Was that part of your remit?
Not in any detail. So basically the way my job worked was they have about 50,000 items that they sold, and I was creating and then crunching a database. And what we would do is we would figure out, based on a year's worth of sales, if they tried to cut a certain percent off their prices across a certain number of hundreds of stores, what would the impact of that be? So bread was probably one of the UPC codes in there, but I didn't pay attention to one product over another.
Mm-hmm. When you were working at McKinsey, did you understand the company's purpose to be exclusively maximizing its own profitability? Did you understand the purpose of the companies you worked for to be exclusively to maximize their profitability?
Well, many of my clients, as you know, were public sector and nonprofit. So obviously their function
sure.
was not
Set
about
those
profitability.
Aside, yeah.
But yes, I worked for a company, a for-profit company.
Do you think that that should be the sole mission of a corporation, though, to maximize profitability?
Well, I think that there's something to be said for the dialogue that's happening with, for example, what's going on in the business roundtable. But also, this is where policy needs to come in. We can't expect corporate America to spontaneously change what it is about without imposing different kinds of left and right boundaries. And to me, where the public sector and the function of regulation meets what private companies do is precisely to set up those kinds of boundaries. So I welcome any time a company undertakes, you know, what is called corporate social responsibility, charitable activity, or other factors in what they care about. I've been very interested to see the development of things like B Corps, which has been a big conversation, especially around South Bend, actually, because one of the pioneering ones was a company called Better World Books that grew kind of up and around Notre Dame. But I also don't think we should be naive about how corporations behave unless they are regulated to ensure that their profit-seeking activities don't cause harm.
You have criticized some of McKinsey's more recent engagements with clients. Do you think that something fundamental has changed about the company since you left?
It's difficult from the outside looking in to gauge whether this reflects some kind of systemic shift or whether they just have a failure in terms of their guardrails. When I was there, there was a lot of talk about values, firm values. So you would hear a lot about a certain kind of ethic, but it was always about putting the client's interest first. What you didn't hear as much was about whether what the client was doing had moral consequences that the firm didn't want to touch. I believe I remember a decision not to serve tobacco had been made by the time I was there. But my point is, there seems to be a problem there with assessing what they want to be associated with, definitely with the ICE work, with the Saudi work, where you just say, you know, this is a company that's good at helping clients meet objectives, but some of those objectives are not something we want anything to do with. And I think they need to step back and reassess what kind of client work they should take on in the first place.
So you have portrayed a lot of the work that you did for McKinsey, like many analysts and junior staffers at consulting work, as mainly crunching data and making PowerPoint presentations, shuffling papers, more or less. Of course, there are also junior consultants and contractors who go to do government work, like Edward Snowden and Reality Winner, who see something that they think is wrongdoing and speak up. Can you tell us your opinion of Mr. Snowden and Ms. Winner's actions?
Well, I think that we ought to have whistleblower protections so that folks like that are not forced to choose between maintaining classified information and speaking up about wrongdoing. And it may well be the case that we're seeing the whistleblower concept work in the way in which the current Ukraine process and investigation came about.
So you think of Edward Snowden as a whistleblower?
Not necessarily. I think he could have been if that framework existed. Instead, I think of him as somebody who divulged classified information.
Next, we wanted to ask Mr. Buttigieg about his struggle to gain traction among Black voters. Specifically, the fumbling of the unveiling of his Douglas plan to address racist systems in America. It covers criminal justice reform, public health care, education, and more. His campaign began promoting a list of prominent Black supporters from South Carolina as endorsing this plan, written in a way that implied support for his candidacy. They didn't. The plan was publicized on his campaign website with a stock photo of a Kenyan woman and a child. It didn't go over well.
Mr. Mayor, can you explain the mistakes that were made around your Douglas plan? Why did your campaign falsely claim support from Black leaders and then use tokenizing stock photos? Can you just talk about how that happened?
So my understanding is that no false statement has ever been made about somebody's support for the plan. My understanding is that there were miscommunications about the public rollout of people's names, all of whom had indicated at some point support for the plan, but not all of whom had reconfirmed that
they called it misleading, having their names
attached to that. So that was a process mistake, obviously, that led to changes in how we communicate with supporters and people that we're in dialogue with about our policies. I don't know as much about the stock photo. I think it was on the website until September. I know that the vendor who was involved in running that part of the website or adding that kind of imagery has not been with the campaign for a while. And obviously, that was a mistake.
How can you win the Democratic nomination, let alone the presidency, without the support of Black voters? And what do you make of the lack of support for your campaign from that community so far?
Well, I believe, first of all, that we're earning support from Black voters. I became mayor and was reelected as mayor largely because of support from every constituency, including the Black community in my city. And I believe that it is...
What's the percentage of Black citizenship there?
About 25%. Yeah. And I carried every district, including the minority-majority districts in our city, in primaries and generals, both times. And I believe that anyone who proposes to be the president ought to be a president for everybody, and also in particular, given what African-Americans are up against in the United States today, that the message of the Democratic Party needs to be one that speaks to Black voters where they are. And it's one of the reasons why we're being very intentional about that. Now, I don't want to plunge in on polling numbers, but the last couple of rounds that came back suggested that the way that I'm viewed among Black voters is roughly the same in terms of the proportions as among white voters, but far more Black voters say they don't know me or don't have an opinion. And I think part of this reflects the fact, certainly something I hear from a lot of Black voters, that folks feel not only abused by the Republican Party, but often taken for granted by the Democratic Party. And so the trust that you can build through quantity time, through longevity, is very important. I don't have the kind of longevity that obviously some of my competitors
have. So how do you overcome that?
First of all, the substance of what we have to offer. I'm really proud of what's in the Douglas plan. It's been praised as the most comprehensive plan on dealing with systemic inequality put forward by a presidential candidate. Not, of course, because I sat in a room and thought up all these brilliant ideas, but because we had a lot of conversation and a lot of dialogue and fit our values to a plan to move forward. But I also think before a lot of folks care what's in your plan, they need to know what's in your heart. And I'm working in not just traditional campaign formats, big speeches and TV appearances, but also we've been doing more and more quiet and smaller engagements. Our recent tour of the South, for example, had a lot of conversations that were between 20 and 50 people, some of them very targeted around a policy issue like health equity or minority entrepreneurship. Some of it more about making sure that I was speaking to and hearing from folks who'd been overlooked. So when we were in South Carolina, for example, we were with a almost all black Democratic group in Allendale County. This is a early presidential primary state, right? They hadn't seen a presidential candidate in more than a decade. And you could feel the extent to which they felt overlooked. And those kinds of engagements, I think, are very important too. It's not just about, obviously, our goal to win. It's about deserving to win.
Your plans for tackling income inequality are not quite as detailed as some of the other candidates. You know, for example, your policies on an inclusive economy say somewhat vaguely that you're going to knock down unfair barriers to entrepreneurship. What would that look like?
So, first of all, we know that there are challenges to access to credit. In fact, virtually every small African-American-owned business that I've visited in this campaign, I ask, how'd you get started? How'd you get your startup money? And they always say they had to come up with the cash. And that's a pattern, of course, that's borne out on everything from how mom-and-pop businesses experience commercial banking to the well-documented fact of VC money almost all going to a small handful of people and kinds of people in a certain number of places. So there are things we can do about that. One thing we can do is capitalize CDFIs better, community development financial institutions that have a much better track record of in turn supporting minority entrepreneurship. The way I would do it would be a 5X CRA super credit for any of the larger institutions to flow funds into CDFIs. Another thing we can do is direct co-investment. This is part of our Walker Lewis initiative in businesses led by those who are underrepresented. Part of it is looking at other things that need to be reformed in credit scoring and credit systems generally. And then part of it is a little deeper in the chain of cause and effect, right? Where we know how much of the wealth in this country is inherited, not just among the ultra wealthy, but just in general.
Sure.
And how that flows through the implications for home ownership and access to education and health and all of the other things that become barriers to folks being able to be empowered economically as they grow up.
Despite being one of two millennial candidates in the race, Tulsi Gabbard is the other, Mr. Buttigieg draws his lowest support from the youngest voters and his best support from the oldest. A December poll revealed younger, more liberal adults were much less likely than their older counterparts to describe Buttigieg as liberal. Meanwhile, a November poll showed he has the highest net favorability among Iowa Democratic caucus goers over 65. Then there's that whole Mayo Pete meme.
Mr. Mayor, you recently said that the failures of the old normal help explain how we got to Trump. So how do you plan to sort of dismantle that old regime? Because in part, one of the issues that I think a lot of especially young people have is that you don't seem nearly as progressive or as revolutionary in some ways as some of the other candidates. And that's something a lot of young people are looking for. So can you explain in a little bit more detail how you plan to do that?
First of all, what I'm proposing would make me the most progressive president in the lifetimes, not only of young people, but I mean, certainly in the last half century. I'll also say that it matters that we hold together an American majority that is progressive enough that it unlocks possibilities that were not available even 10 years ago during the Obama presidency. So it took everything that the Democratic Party had just to push through a healthcare reform in the ACA invented by conservatives, right? And that was a major achievement. But that was as far as you could get during the constraints of that time. Where we are right now is that there is a powerfully large, not everybody obviously, but a powerfully large American majority, not only to do the right thing on areas where Democrats have generally been trusted, wages, labor, health, but also areas where we've been on defense, like immigration, guns. Holding that majority together is a big part of the task of the next president. I'm not just talking about how to win an election. I'm talking about how to govern this country. And we need to have enough clarity of vision that we can see that the boldness of an idea is not measured only by how many people it can alienate, but by what it can get done. So there's always a more extreme solution on offer that sometimes I'll be competing with. But I also want to be very clear that what I'm talking about would make the next era, what I'm proposing we do, would make the next era very different from the one we've been living in.
How do you convey that to younger voters? How do you counter the Mayo Pete memes? Are you familiar?
Okay. Do I want to know?
You haven't heard that expression yet?
Well, mayonnaise, as I think and a lot of people think, is really, really gross. And there have been teens.
Wait a minute.
Mayonnaise is delicious.
Let's not get on track. Anyway,
wait a minute.
People feel strongly about mayo. And there have been younger people. There's a meme going around called Mayo Pete. And that, I think, does speak a little bit to the lack of youth support that you currently hold, even compared to those who are significantly older than
you. A more generous interpretation is it's bland.
Okay.
Yes. And white.
And mayo. White.
And white.
And white.
I get the white part.
I didn't mean to imply that you're gross. I'm just saying. That's not what I meant.
First of all, again, trying to get folks to look at how big these ideas are. I mean, I'm talking about the biggest reform in the American healthcare system we've had since Medicare was invented. I'm talking about a game-changing transformation on the availability of funds to go to college. I'm talking about getting our climate carbon neutral by 2050. That will test the limits of human capacity. And there will always be some folks who say healthcare reform isn't real unless you obliterate the entire private industry. College isn't real unless even the child of a billionaire can go without paying a penny in tuition. The climate change thing doesn't count unless it's trillions more dollars than it is. And that's just not how I measure the bigness of an idea.
If I can put this question in a slightly different way, you have been on the front lines of corporate downsizing. You've been on the front lines of corporate price fixing. You've been on the front lines of our misadventures in foreign policy. You've had direct experience of many of the things that make a lot of young people very angry about the way that this country is operating right now. You don't seem to embody that anger.
So the proposition that I've been on the front lines of corporate price fixing is bullshit, just to get that out of the way.
You worked for a company that was fixing bread prices.
No. I worked for a consulting company that had a client that may have been involved in fixing, or was apparently in a scandal. I was not aware of the Canadian bread pricing scandal until last night.
But do you feel the anger that many young people feel about the state of this
country? Yeah, of course, because it destroyed my city. I grew up surrounded by crumbling factories and empty houses. My city lost 30,000 of its 130,000 people, largely before I was born. So I'm under no illusions about the problems that are present in American capitalism generally and were unleashed beginning with the Reagan era specifically. And while I may not be as emotive sometimes about my sense of anger or frustration or injustice, and I would argue that some people are given more room to be emotive than others, I would not be doing any of this if I were not propelled by a level of passion. Look, let's talk about why I walked away from the private sector in order to go to Indiana to run as a statewide Democratic candidate during the Tea Party wave of 2010. On a platform of defending Barack Obama's economic policy, knowing that I would in all likelihood get my ass handed to me, which is what happened, but recognizing that the treatment of auto workers by our incumbent state treasurer in a dispute which very few people followed but really fired me up showed everything that was wrong about the way that our politicians, our corporations, our workers, and our communities were interacting. And even though I didn't win, as expected, I also never regretted the fact that even though I spent down all my savings doing it, with an income of, I think, $450 a month from the Navy being what I had during that year.
So much for those McKinsey dollars, right?
Well, I spent them all, right? I saved them up, and then I spent them all. This is one of the reasons why I am by far the least wealthy person running for president right now. I guess my point is my decision to take on that fight, and subsequently my decision to serve my hometown at the time that it was written off as dying, propelled by my acute awareness of the things that are wrong.
I'm wondering if in the time we have, if you could give specific solutions to say what the government could do to address the growing financial inequities, what the government could do about the power of the financial industry, about the corruption of politics, about the corruption of industry itself.
Yeah. I mean, I would argue that the proposals I've put forward on dealing with precisely this set of problems is more specific than most of my competitors. And that's everything from my proposal to double the rate of unionization in this country to my insistence that we increase the minimum wage to some of the other labor market reforms I've proposed around taking care of contractors and gig workers to campaign finance reforms up to and including a constitutional amendment to end Citizens United, not to mention things we could do in the shorter run ranging from ideas already baked into H.R. 1 around drowning out dark money to heavier lift reforms around public financing of campaigns while we are working the bigger generational fight on things like Citizens United. I believe that we need to be investing in the sources of social mobility and domestic competitiveness to include my proposal that we triple funding for Title I in education, to include everything that's contemplated in the Douglas plan, to include what we need to do around infrastructure, and that in order to do that, we must raise taxes on wealthy individuals and on corporations. So financial transactions tax, rollback wholesale of the Trump tax cuts with a special focus on what's going on in the corporate rate tax cut, close the 199A loophole, deal with some of the enforcement deficiencies that are driving a big part of the revenue gap right now, I think. I'm also open to a wealth tax. I just would not put my signature proposal in a position of being completely dependent on a tax that is constitutionally untested. But in principle, I think it's fine. I'm just not counting on it.
How would you double unionization?
We have penalties for company interference in union elections, but the penalties are so weak that even when they are imposed by what I view as a much weakened enforcement structure, both in terms of the Department of Labor and NLRB, even when they are imposed, they're not really enough to change behavior, which is why I've specified the need for fines in the adequate range of the multi-millions that would actually make it a different calculation for companies to make it difficult to unionize. And we need an end to right to work.
Mayor Buttigieg publicly came out in 2015 while running for a re-election as mayor of South Bend. Doing that in the state that elected Mike Pence governor is brave. Going on to win in that state is impressive. He's breaking barriers as the first openly gay candidate to mount a major campaign for the U.S. presidency.
When you say some people are given latitude to be more emotive than others, what are you talking about?
I am sometimes asked to be more, I don't know, have more of a flourish in displaying my emotions. Mm-hmm. And it is precisely because I feel very strongly about lots of things that I've learned to master how I might feel about anything and channel that into action. Now, I still take great pleasure in firing up a crowd that agrees with me on something I'm passionate about.
Right.
But I'm also mindful as the new guy that maybe waving my arms is not the best way to convey what I care about.
But who's given more room to be emotive than you?
Others.
What do you see as real advantages or challenges as being the first openly gay candidate for a major party?
I mean, I'll tell you a couple things that it means right now, which are very powerful, which is young people letting me know that I'm helping them in some way just by doing this. And not even just young queer people. The really exciting thing was when a teenager let me know that my campaign helped her feel like she had a sense of belonging in her school and her environment, even though she had autism. So that idea of representing difference in a way that that validates us.
This makes you less mayo, so
maybe. Hopefully it's at least a better flavor in the mayo. I don't know. Anyway, it's not unusual. I would say every rope line, maybe not every rope line, but often, somebody comes up to me, looks at me, starts to try to say something and can't. They're usually in their 50s or older. And I know exactly what they're saying, and that's all it takes. It's not why I got into this race, but it's part of what this campaign means, and I'm very mindful of that. I'm also very mindful from a historic perspective that usually when somebody had, well, we don't have nearly enough examples, but when somebody's broken a barrier going into the presidency, it's usually not been the first person to make the attempt. So the first woman president will not be the first woman to run for president. The first African-American president was not the first African-American to run for president. So analytically, I'm conscious of the fact that I seek the presidency. If elected, I'd be the first out gay president. And I'm the first elected official to make the attempt.
Mr. Mayor, I wanted to ask you a little bit about reproductive rights. Mm. When you've talked about your support for abortion rights, you've in the past said that you've taken cues from the Bible. I'm curious how you connect with both voters and lawmakers who have a very different interpretation from the Bible, that abortion is maybe a sin or even akin to murder. Mm-hmm. Or do you even try to change their minds or reach them?
First of all, my interpretation of my religion has no business being imposed on anyone else through policy. So I've occasionally shared my own understanding of the verses beginning with Genesis about the breath of life that associate the beginning of life with breath. But that is a personal encounter with Scripture that is not for anybody else to have to live with from a policy perspective. I think that different people reach different good faith conclusions about when life begins, which is a metaphysical and in certain ways unknowable question, which is exactly why I think the consensus, or at least the decision we've got to reach, is not to convince one another to draw the same line in the same place, but to reach a decision or consensus about who gets to draw the line. Not where to draw the line, but who should draw the line.
So I appreciate that you take your biblical interpretation out of the policy arena, but that's certainly not true of the other side.
True.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and this is the problem, right? This is the problem with certain versions of how some people want to bring religion into politics, which is not just as a formation of conscience. I think we have an obligation to be transparent about how our conscience is formed, but something that they believe others ought to have to live by. And obviously, as a member of the LGBTQ community, I've seen the consequences of other people believing their interpretation of their religion ought to be imposed on me. And we see something similar in the fight against abortion rights.
Can you give us some names of people you'd consider nominating to the Supreme Court?
I think it's irresponsible for me to name check folks for the future.
Trump did it.
And he is not my role model on things like this.
But it helped him.
I'm sure it did. Lots of things he did helped him that I will not be emulating. I can tell you that there are justices now. I mean, folks like, you can look at the jurisprudence of somebody like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You can look at the historic contributions of figures like Thurgood Marshall and get some sense of what would guide my philosophy.
Can you talk a little bit about your plan, the 15-member Supreme Court plan that you've made?
Again, I do not want to claim credit for having invented this, but it was published in the Yale Law Journal, I think in the current edition, as part of an article contemplating options for structural reform that go beyond the debate about court packing. I'm not talking about changing the court in order to make it liberal. More liberal. My appointments will make it more liberal, but at least by the lights of the way these debates are tracked. But I'm talking about a structural reform to change the political stakes of judicial appointments. And the one you're mentioning that I think deserves to be considered is called a balanced bench. And the idea is you have 15 justices overall, 10 of them arrive in the traditional, you might say, partisan process that we're used to. The other 5 can only be seated by a unanimous agreement of the other 10. And the idea is that there will be a depoliticization of those choices. And it might be on a rotating basis. I think the authors in the Yale Law Journal suggest that they be rotated up from the appellate bench. That gets you away from these strange phenomena like the Kennedy brief, where a whole body of casework is done to appeal to the idiosyncrasies of a single perceived swing justice. But more importantly, to make sure that every vacancy doesn't turn into another apocalyptic ideological firefight.
More from our interview after a quick break.
This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sex espionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets, and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in LA, binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice. We asked all of the candidates how they were thinking about big tech monopolies, but few have the kind of intimate relationship with Facebook like Mayor Pete does. In October, Bloomberg News reported that Mark Zuckerberg advised Mr. Buttigieg on his tech campaign hires. We wanted to get to the bottom of his relationship with Silicon Valley.
You've spoken, and I believe you told Vox recently that breaking up big tech should be an option. It seems like your proposal is somewhat more vague than some of your opponents. One of the things you mentioned was doubling antitrust enforcement budgets. Can you tell me a little bit about how you plan to go about evaluating whether breaking up should happen? Like for Facebook, for example, do you think Facebook should be broken up right now?
Yeah. So I think there's a strong case for that. The reason I don't think it makes sense for me to say as a candidate, this company shall be broken up is the same reason I don't think I wouldn't generally say of the outcome of a trial in a judicial process.
But you can think about their power, right? Right now, as you see it, the influence that they have in modern politics,
yeah,
and say this needs to change.
Yes, and that's the problem with Facebook. No one company and no one person should have the kind of power that they've accumulated. Now, under our existing framework, it was designed to handle monopolies mostly in terms of pricing power. Pricing power is not the biggest worry around the harms that the scope and power of Facebook and other large tech companies have accumulated is, right? One set of issues has to do with data security and data privacy. That requires a national data law and stronger privacy and security protections. But frankly, dealing with the monopoly problem is neither necessary nor sufficient to fix that. In other words, that's a standalone set of issues that has to happen because a small company could misbehave with data too. Then we got the monopoly concern. And to put a little more meat on some of what you mentioned, one of the things I think we're going to need is a standard that shifts the burden to large companies, especially when they're making acquisitions like the acquisition of WhatsApp by Facebook that are likely anti-competitive.
Can you also speak to your relationship with Mark Zuckerberg?
Yeah, so we're in college at the same time. We've got a lot of mutual friends. And doesn't mean we agree on a lot of things. I'm sure he would vigorously disagree with my assessment of the WhatsApp acquisition, for example.
Do you think he holds too much power right now as a individual citizen?
Yes, no one should have that kind of power. Now, part of the problem is that a social network is a natural monopoly, right? So if we were just talking about what you might call the Facebook part of Facebook, right, the product that people are most familiar with, if you broke that up, you just wind up with two of them, and one of them would die, and one of them would be the new one. The real problem is how a corporation of that size acquires other competitors and develop certain powers. And then there's a problem of their refusal to accept their responsibility for speech that they make money from. So if a cable company or a newspaper, right, if somebody can show that an ad that you all were going to run is false, you would pull it. And yet, Facebook doesn't want to hold themselves to that same standard. The problem is, it shouldn't just be left to companies to decide how to solve these problems. There needs to be a policy response. Basically, what we've done is we've outsourced public policy decisions around the limits of speech and misinformation and the handling and the use of data to the companies, which are so big that when they make a corporate policy decision, in effect, they're actually making a public policy decision.
One of the things that has stood out to the board is the way that the mayor seamlessly infuses his Episcopalian faith on the campaign trail in a genuine way. We were curious about the role his faith would play if he is to serve as commander-in-chief of the military.
Given your faith, how do you reconcile directing the largest, most powerful military in the world with your Christian obligation to love your neighbor? Or enemy, excuse me. And your neighbor, but mostly your enemies.
It's one of the biggest problems of being involved in the military at any level. And I suppose we're all implicated in this just by belonging to this country. You also have to rationalize as a citizen how you participate in a society or a country that sometimes does things that are, even when it's doing the so-called right thing from the perspective of law or the law of war, is still doing something that would not be considered Christian or moral by the lights of any number of different faith traditions. Some people take the approach of punching out completely, right? That's the Walden approach, I guess. I think you have to accept the reality that you are living and working in a broken world, just as we are all broken human beings, and try to order your steps in a way that brings greater good than harm. Look, when you're in charge of something important, most of when you earn your paycheck is when you're making decisions between two courses of action, both of which involve harm, not just to your objectives, but often to your values. And you have to figure out what the right thing is to do. And that's true for, I think, any position of executive leadership, but certainly when you're in charge of a government body or a military unit, or the entire country, and making those life and death decisions. That's what you have to weigh. It's not finding what the perfect answer is. Well, it isn't a McKinsey puzzle where you might be able to compute the right answer. Moral puzzles are different because they don't have a correct final answer. They have courses of action, some of which can do more good and some of which can do more harm.
So the number of countries that the United States military now has troops in is somewhat astounding. Can you make the case for why we need to have an American presence in, for instance, the African nation of Mali?
So we need to maintain the ability to project force in a way that will protect the homeland and meet our core security and national objectives. What I will also say is that there are a lot of troops deployed around the world right now pursuant to an AUMF that was passed to deal with 9/11. The AUMF had no sunset. And the scope creep, most recently, I think, brought to life by the Afghanistan papers, but we've been looking at it for more than a decade, is one of the reasons why I believe that a future AUMF should always have a 3-year sunset. And let's have that debate. If a president, if I or any other president, believe in my judgment from a national security perspective, that it's appropriate to have troops deployed somewhere, I should be able to convince Congress of that. Not to mention the fact that the war powers are supposed to inhere in Congress anyway. And by the way, this also helps with the fact that Congress has been all too happy, I think, not to get involved in questions like whether the AUMF that was supposed to deal with 9/11 justifies troops being in Mali or Niger. So some of these deployments are problematic, and we need a much more crisply defined mission, both for the war on terror in general and for future military engagements, even while recognizing that we are going to have a base architecture globally that ensures that we maintain global military superiority, especially as we get into a more and more multipolar world.
Since you brought it up, can I ask you about the Afghanistan papers? Were you surprised by their sort of broad conclusions that the public has been lied to for a great many years about the possibility of success?
Angered, but honestly not completely surprised. I remember these debates raging in the time that I was deployed, and you could argue that was very late in the war. In fact, I thought it was the end of the war. I thought I was one of the last troops turning out the lights. That was years ago. And I even remember they posted one of those inscrutable PowerPoints on the wall of the gym by the treadmills. And I remember staring at it. And the PowerPoint was supposed to hold the lines of effort that constituted the mission as OEF turned into Resolute Support. And just squinting at it and thinking, I know a fair amount about why we thought we were here. And I can't make sense of this.
So if the mission is unclear and civilian casualties are at an all-time high now, is the war being waged there in a morally defensible way, to go back to what you were talking about before?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's some of our moral intuitions that keep us chasing after some lofty and possibly impossible outcomes.
Possibly impossible?
Let me rephrase. Well, it's not that it's impossible. They're not impossible. It's not impossible for Afghanistan to become a thriving, prosperous, democratic state, but it is impossible for that to happen quickly. It is impossible for it to happen before the time has come when we need to withdraw our troop presence, which is to say that time has come and it hasn't happened.
The Trump administration's been trying to do it for 3 years now. How would you do it any sort of quicker than that?
Trump administration's not big on decision-making. And also not big on multilateral diplomacy. In order to do this, the thing we have going for us is that leaving Afghanistan is possibly the one thing that all of the parties think ought to happen. The U.S. left, the U.S. right, the international community, the Taliban, and in the long run, the Afghan government all want to see this happen. So the question is, when we leave, are we going to leave well or are we going to leave poorly? And what leaving well looks like is to make sure that there is some kind of negotiated political settlement that gets us here, not based on a spontaneous invitation to Camp David, but based on a proper level of engagement with the government, the Afghan government, I mean, the Taliban, and regional players that play a hugely important role in that area. I'm thinking about Pakistan in particular.
Mr. Mayor, can I ask you about immigration? Are you going to, as president, reverse some of President Trump's policies, his agreements with third world countries on asylum, or not letting asylum seekers await the judgment within the United States? What would be your criteria for deportations?
When it comes to asylum seekers, first of all, let's recognize that measures like the Family Case Management Program worked. Virtually everybody in that program appeared when they were supposed to. And so I would not continue the Remain in Mexico policy. And we need to recognize in our policies and in our tone the idea that asylum is a right. The thrust of my vision on immigration centers on legislative reform. But up front, we know that there need to be actions to ensure that family separation can't happen again. To the extent that the government is in the business of housing at all, I believe that should be handled by HHS, which is designed around health, and not by Customs and Border Protection, which is not set up for that kind of role. And number of other steps that we got to take right away. It is perfectly self-defeating to threaten to withdraw aid from, for example, the Central American Triangle countries, when by far the best way forward to prevent a migration crisis in our interest is to make sure that people are living prosperous or at least minimally can count on safety in their own home countries, part of which can be supported with American investment.
But people will continue trying to reach the United States. What would you do as president if tens of thousands of Central Americans showed up at the border?
Well, we still need to maintain a border. It matters. And crossing the border illegally will be illegal when I'm president, too.
Next, we wanted to ask Mr. Buttigieg about healthcare, not just his public option plan, but the other health issues facing America.
Do you think that families should be able to obtain religious or personal exemptions for mandatory vaccination?
we've seen the public health impact of, I can't even call it pseudoscience, but the way that people have been steered off of things that are necessary. This is complex. Different states have different frameworks, some of which acknowledge these kinds of exemptions and some of which don't. I acknowledge that those differences exist among the states, but we have to move toward a world of universal vaccination.
And I just want to talk a little bit very quickly about the public option, which is what you've supported in terms of healthcare reform. You know, you've said yourself a couple of times today that this is still actually a bold vision. It's kind of sort of gotten framed as weak sauce relative to Medicare for All, but it's actually still a pretty heavy lift. So can you talk a little bit about how you see getting that through Congress, which is there's going to be a lot of opposition, and what you think it would cost?
So Medicare for All, if you want it, has strong support. And often when people tell pollsters they're for Medicare for All, this is what they mean, right? And so there's issue after issue where what we've got to do is manage the daylight between what commands a majority among the American people and what can get a majority in the American Congress. A part of that is why we need structural reforms, why we've got to do something about things like gerrymandering and other issues that help to explain why Congress is the way it is. But I also believe that a very good use of the president's time and energy is to be personally present in even conservative states or districts where measures like this have popular support. And I don't think there's anything fanciful about this because you can just look at the political life of the ACA, which, again, was toxic for Democrats in 2010 when I was getting crushed in my first experience on the ballot in Indiana. And by 2018 was the winning issue for Democrats, such that even when the Republicans controlled everything, they could not make good on their central campaign promise, even when they were in charge. So we scored it at $1.5 trillion over 10 years. In order to achieve that, actually a fully 1.4 of it can be recouped just from rolling back the corporate tax rate portion of the Trump tax cuts. For the other 0.1, $100 billion, I would account that as part of the savings that we will get from the negotiation of prescription drug prices by Medicare and HHS, which I think narrowly that move alone CBO had between $300 and $400 billion over a decade. We believe the overall savings to the Treasury of the different moves we aim to make would come to over $600 billion. But anyway, I only need 0.1 to make up the gap between 1.4 and 1.5.
So here's the thing I kind of want to talk about.
Yeah.
$1.5 trillion is a lot less than Medicare for All than Elizabeth Warren's plan would cost, right? But that's over 10 years. If your plan succeeds and more people choose the public option versus private insurance, beyond 10 years, it could become quite expensive. What do you say to arguments that ultimately it would be just as expensive as something like Medicare for All? So why not just do that?
Well, the problem with Medicare for All, or that version of Medicare for All that my competitors have, isn't just the cost, but it's also the idea of dictating to people what their choice ought to be. There's a comparable danger of policy arrogance in supposing that we can guess from Washington the correct number of years before the transition should happen. And so what I'm supporting is a way for the transition to be organic.
So that was most of the editorial board's interview with South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg. To read the full conversation, visit nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. To hear the board's impression of the mayor's visit and for an explainer of his proposed changes to the Supreme Court, check out the deliberation episode. It was also released today. We'll be back in your feed tomorrow with the board's conversation with former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. See you then.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley.
for the love of home.